Welcome to Local Gov Matters, the podcast that talks about the latest issues facing Wisconsin. In this podcast, we discuss what's happening at the state capitol and in counties around the state. You'll hear from state elected officials, county leaders, and other experts and advocates. We'll provide the local impact of state legislation and insights into how county government works and how it impacts you. It's the background, the stories, and even some insider baseball that will help you frame the issues and make it worth your listen. So whether you're sitting at your desk, driving in your car, or enjoying your morning coffee, we're thrilled you joined us. Let's get started. Welcome to Local Gov Matters, the podcast of the Wisconsin Counties Association. I'm Michelle Gormican-Thompson, Communications Consultant with the Wisconsin Counties Association.
And I am Mark O'Connell, President and CEO of the Wisconsin Counties Association.
Mark, we have a wonderful guest today.
We do. We have Dale Knapp, Director of Forward Analytics, really the preeminent research entity in the state of Wisconsin, highly respected, well-regarded, known all over the state by the legislature, policymakers, local government officials, the private sector. Forward Analytics has really made a name for itself in a relatively short period of time. Dale, I guess before we get going on today's topic, which Michelle will lead us into, tell us a little bit about Forward Analytics and what it is you do and all the interesting things you've studied over the years.
Sure. Forward Analytics has been around since 2018. And we are a nonpartisan public policy economic research entity. And so we do research on the major issues facing Wisconsin. We've recently done things on migration, on the fentanyl problem, on housing in Wisconsin, the housing challenge. So we've covered a wide variety of topics and hoping to bring these challenges to light, if possible, identify possible solutions to them. Sometimes there's not any easy solutions, but at least make policymakers and the public aware of the challenges so that we can ultimately solve these and make Wisconsin an even better place to live.
Now, Dale, you're an economist, but not everything is economy and numbers. You do policy work, too. These are not just analytical or statistical analyses. These are policy issues, social issues.
They are. The basic research is, through economic means, et cetera. But we think along the lines of policy as well and how we can solve these problems, what policies need to be implemented, how we need to change public policy in certain ways to solve these problems. And one of the really, I think the most important thing that we do here that's a little bit different from other places is we're very forward-looking. We're thinking 10 years out, 15 years out, what are the challenges now? What are they going to look like in the future? And how do we get ahead of these challenges before they become really big problems?
That's an interesting way to put it. If we keep solving today's challenges, we will always be solving today's challenges. You're trying to make us aware, I suspect, of the challenges that are coming down the road, which are relatively small today. And if we take action today, we may not have that challenge in the future. Dale, Michelle's going to lead us into the latest report that you did, but as I'm listening to this podcast and I'm out in the state of Wisconsin, where can I find all of the reports that you've done thus far? Do you have a website or can people contact you directly?
Yeah, we have a website. It's forward-analytics.net. And one of the great things about this is, a lot of these research entities, you have to pay, for the research. You have to pay $10, $15. It's all free to the public. You can download any of our research items. And if you have questions, our contact information is there. Give me a call, drop me an email, and I'll walk you through what you need to know.
Now, these are not reports that are going to take me days to read. You put these together in a succinct way that a regular person can understand what it is you've delved into and what the various challenges are. Is that right?
That's right. Our audience, our target audience is obviously the legislature, other public officials, and the general public. And so they're relatively brief 8 to 10 pages of text, usually maybe a little bit more, but not written in an economic way, but written so that the general public can easily digest what's there, what's most important, what they should get out of it.
When you read the Forward Analytics reports, you're a smarter person, and I am. I'm happy to say that I have looked at all of your reports, and it is no wonder why Forward Analytics is the most respected research entity in the state of Wisconsin. And quite frankly, as I've traveled all over this country, your work is known throughout this nation, and it is very, very well regarded. Michelle, we've got the latest report. What's it all about, and what's Dale going to tell us?
Well, Dale, we're always talking about the latest issues, as you just mentioned here. So your latest report, K-12 on the ballot, using a referenda to fund public schools. Why don't you start up by just telling us, give us a full understanding of how are schools currently funded in Wisconsin for our listeners to understand that, and where does the referenda fit into that?
Sure, and we're going to keep this at a very high level because school funding in Wisconsin is very complex. But the referenda component of school funding comes out of what are called revenue limits, school revenue limits, which were established in 1994, and they were created because school property tax levies were growing 8, 9, 10% a year. And the legislature wanted to bring that down, have some limits on the amount of increase in property taxes. So they created the revenue limit law, which simply caps the amount of revenue districts can generate from a combination of general school aids, which is the biggest form of state school aid.
That's state money, Dale.
And their property tax levy. And then every 2 years during the budget, the legislature allows a per-student increase in those. So it's based on enrollment, and that's going to be a critical point when we come forward. And so when it was originally created, the increases that were in there were supposed to be tied to inflation, and they were. But the legislature said, well, there might be times when you need more money for, you might be expanding a program for a variety of reasons. But they expected the referenda to be sort of not used a whole lot. But it comes out of that. So they said, if you need more money, go to your voters, ask them, explain to them why you need it. If they agree with that, they'll approve the referenda, and you'll be able to spend more money.
So we have state aid money, which is state taxes.
State taxes.
And they dole it out to all the districts with some kind of a formula. And then local units, local jurisdictions, local school districts can generate more money through a property tax. And the way that we exceed that, or district gets more money, is if the state allocates more money in the formula, or a school district can say, well, we need some more, let's go to referenda. The legislature said, you want more money from the taxpayers, go get a referendum.
That's right. You know, and that's sort of the local control component.
And Dale, when you talk about the referenda, this isn't the building of a new high school. This is strictly operational expenses. Is that correct? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So there's really two types of referenda. One is for operating purposes, for an expanded program, et cetera. And the other type that are out there are for capital projects, for building a new school, for adding on to a new school, for refurbishing those. We're not talking about the second kind.
Those are the ones you usually hear about.
A lot of times they're the ones that you do hear about, yes.
Building a new stadium or building an auditorium or a pool or a new building. Those are the ones that get all the media. But what you're talking about in this report is basic operations of the schools.
Basic operations to make sure that we have enough funding for the programs that we want to provide for our young children.
Well, so Dale, if you're saying the referenda – well, I guess let me ask. Since the legislature gave school districts this authority to get more money in operations through a referendum, in other words, a question on the ballot when you go to vote, have we had more of them lately or less of them lately?
Well, I would say we've had a lot. We've had a lot of them, put it that way. So originally, it was rare. There were under 35 in the first 4 years. And that's sort of what the legislature was expecting.
What years was, it, what was that?
From 94 to 97.
Okay.
Very few.
Okay.
Since then, we're averaging almost 60 a year. And we've had 85% of school districts have gone to referendum during this time period. So essentially, it's become sort of something that everybody chooses to do. Some have to, some choose to, whatever that is. But essentially, nearly everybody has gone to referendum to seek more money.
Well, it almost seems like schools for operations have gone to a three-legged stool: state aid, local property taxes, and now a referendum. When it used to be a referendum only for something extraordinary.
Yes.
And is there a problem? I mean, is the school aid formula inadequate, not working? Are the current limits too restrictive? What's the problem?
Well, I think there's really two components to this problem. And one is declining enrollment in school districts. So again, like as I mentioned earlier, these limits are tied to the number of students you have, which makes some sense. So if you have fewer students, you're probably not spending as much.
Except there's always a critical mass that you have to spend, whether you have one student or 1,000 students. You're a certain amount of infrastructure. But
that's right.
Besides that.
That's right. But what the revenue limit law does is as you start losing students, originally, it starts tightening your increases, and then your revenues begin to fall. But the challenge is, if you're losing 60 kids over 12 grades, you're not really able to lay off a teacher or a staff member. At some point, you will be able to, but the revenue limit law requires cuts much faster than really district finances can handle. I call school district spending really lumpy. So at some point, that mass has sort of dropped enough where, okay, now you can restructure, you can reduce your staff by two or three or four or something. But by the time that comes, you may have to have cut $1 million from your budget. So there's that mismatch. So that's one of the challenges. And that's why we see a lot of declining enrollment districts going to referendum, because of that. The second big factor is increases since 2012 that have not only have not matched inflation, but really haven't even come close to inflation. So since 2012, if you look from 2012 to 2023, almost 400 of 421 school districts had revenue increases not only below inflation, but significantly below inflation, 30%, 40% below inflation. So you can't keep up with, raises for even your staff for anything. You're constantly cutting because the cost of everything you're doing is going up, but your revenues aren't growing.
Well, this relates to, I guess, a previous report of Forward Analytics, where we talked about not enough young people. We're not producing enough, creating enough, attracting enough. We're not growing enough. So I guess thinking back to my days, when I'm not sure if they even have homerooms anymore in schools, but when we were in high school, you had a homeroom. All right, let's say we have 30 homerooms across the high school, probably more than that these days, but let's say 30. And every homeroom lost 4 students. That's 120 students. And if the per student aid is $1,000, we're well over $100,000 in less revenue. But I can't cut a single teacher. I cannot cut a single maintenance person. I can't cut I can't cut anyone. Yet I'm over $100,000 short. So that puts me in a very that means is that we're going to have less technology for the kids that I have there. I can't afford that. We're going to have less lab equipment. Maybe I can't instruct the young people the way I wish to, which I suppose would have some sort of a long-term effect on test scores. And we have a population of young people that is less prepared to be successful in post-secondary and post-high school education.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, when the law was created, this is in the 90s. Remember, population was booming in the 90s. We weren't really thinking about pervasive declining enrollment. And we really have that. And it's given birth rates. It's going to continue for a decade or more. And so this is a problem. We have school districts now that have been declining in enrollment for 20 years. At some point, you get to a point where there is nothing left to cut in terms of staff. You just can't cut anymore. You've become so small. And so it's a challenge of, okay, how do we deal with that? How do we tweak this formula? Or maybe it's the overall school funding formula that it deals with that pervasive declining enrollment and how we educate these kids in these sparse declining enrollment districts.
And I guess that's what you're saying in this report, in part, because we've had such an increase in the use of referenda for operations. What that's really telling us is that we need to take a hard look at how we're funding K-12.
Yeah, think about this. This school year will be the 40th anniversary of this of revenue limits, and we've never taken a good hard look at it. What's working? What's not working? And hopefully this is a wake up call to say that there are components of this law that really aren't working. Let's take a good look at it. See what's working, see what's not, and make it better so that, one, we protect taxpayers, and two, we ensure that we are adequately funding students.
We have been talking with the director of Forward Analytics, economist Dale Knapp. Forward Analytics is the most highly regarded and well-respected research entity in the state of Wisconsin, and Dale Knapp runs that show.
Please stay with us, and when we return, we're going to discuss why certain districts are using referenda and why others are foregoing it.
The Wisconsin Counties Association represents Wisconsin's 72 counties at both the state and federal level. Learn more about how counties impact your community at wicounties.org.
Welcome back to Local Gov Matters, the podcast of the Wisconsin Counties Association. We are sitting down today with Dale Knapp, Director of Forward Analytics, discussing his latest report, K-12 on the Ballot, Using Referenda to Fund Public Schools. Dale, welcome back.
Thank you.
We've missed you. So, Dale, in your report, you state that the amount of referendum-approved dollars from K-12 schools has grown rapidly, and this funding increased from $32 million in 2000 to $180 million in 2010 and $650 million in 2023. What do you think this means long-term for our school districts? And as Mark had mentioned, is this current funding mechanism working anymore?
Yeah, that $650 million, I guess, really surprised me. One of the biggest aid programs outside of the state school, the general school aids, maybe the biggest state aid to school districts is aid for special education. In 2023, that was $517 million. So we're using referenda more even than the biggest categorical aid program to schools. So that's a really big number. And again, the growth over the past decade or so has been extremely high. But when you look at sort of what share of spending is this in terms of how much is this covering? So if you just look statewide, this big picture, 2023, referenda dollars are funding about 5.6% of school education funding. If you look just at the districts that are using it, it's over 7%. Those are really big numbers in terms of spending. But I think really the most important number that came out of here, the most startling for me, again, we have 421 school districts in the state. In 100 of them, referenda funding is over 10% of their education funding, of their education spending. That's a number that's unsustainable. If you have to come back every 3 or 4 or 5 years and continue to ask for more money, we have three districts that are over, that this funding is over 40% of their education funding. Again, that's really, it seems to me, unsustainable.
So is there, that just seems that there would be just ripe for voter fatigue, correct? I mean, what is long-term for a district like that, taking that much of their funding from referenda?
Well, again, you're right. At some point, voters are going to say, no, we can't afford anymore. One of the surprising findings in this, though, was you would expect, one of the things you hear commonly is about the referenda. Well, we don't like it because rich districts are much more likely to approve them than the poor districts. And logically, that makes some sense. But when you look at the numbers, it's reversed. The poorest 10% of districts, no matter how you measure it, actually are approving referenda at a higher rate than anybody else, any other income group or wealth group. And I believe the reason is, again, these are generally the sparse, declining enrollment districts. They're, the revenue limit law has basically caused them to squeeze down to, they can't squeeze any more out. And so they're voting out of necessity. They see what's happening in their schools, and the only option for them, whether they can afford it or not, the only option is to say yes, because without that, there's the risk of closure. There's the risk of programs being cut. And so they're saying yes. But at some point, they're going to say no, because they really can't afford it anymore.
Well, that's the issue of sustainability, I suppose, Dale. I mean, in looking at the report, the districts with declining enrollment appear to be approving referenda at a higher rate, not just the less wealthy, but declining enrollment. So if I'm to combine those two, if I'm a district that is not as wealthy as my neighbors, and I have decreasing enrollment, are we not placing a larger and larger burden on the remaining people in that district to keep their schools open or running? And how sustainable is that?
Well, and the other point that it's not sustainable, and I think the other point that has to be made, in a lot of these declining enrollment districts, one of the reason they're declining, there's fewer young people young families in those districts. So the senior population is growing and growing and growing. Again, they're on fixed incomes. They're not still earning generally not earning a paycheck that's growing 2, 3, 4, 5% a year. You're going to keep coming back to referendum to a population on a fixed income. That's harder and harder for those seniors to say yes. They would love to be able to say yes, but they're just looking at it like, I can't do this anymore. That's what makes it really difficult.
And it seems it has a further effect. If we are asking our residents, a particular school district, and let's assume for a moment that the boundaries of the city are the boundaries of the school district for sake of argument, and that city is in a county. If the school has had several referenda and therefore asked their residents to pay more in school taxes to keep the schools operational, I imagine that the city and the county is aware of that, so they might be a little more hesitant to have a referenda themselves or to ask taxpayers for dollars necessary to keep the city running at optimal level or the county to maintain the fabric of society, which really puts enormous pressure on, as you put it, the fixed income residents of a district, some of whom might say, why should I be paying for the schools at all? I don't have any children in the school district, or maybe never had children in the school district. And what do we, although, I mean, that's a larger argument. We could talk all day about that, why it's necessary for all of us to care about an educated population. But nonetheless, the sustainability of this is a major question mark.
Yeah. And again, I think that's why we need to seriously look at this. Again, when the law was created, the whole referendum option was to be used sparingly. That was, you know, in very specific situations. Not, you know, 50, 60, 70 times, you know, each year across the state, you know, districts having had 10, 11, 12 referenda over the past couple of decades. There gets to be voter fatigue at some point. And again, that makes it harder for the county to go to referenda if they need something, even a building project that they may need. The municipality to go to referendum for something, it's harder for them to do those kinds of things when they know that we've already had, three, four increases in school funding because of what's happening in our schools.
I don't mean to be extrapolating something from the report that isn't there, Dale, but if I'm to kind of sum this up, initially, as you put it, the referenda was to be used sparingly. In the case of a very unique situation, a desperate need for additional operating that because the state aid and or property taxes were not sufficient in a special circumstance. But it's come to be utilized as a regular tool for funding of schools. Now, and this is the part I don't mean to put words in the mouth of the author of the report, but it worked well in the beginning, but because we're relying on it so much today, that's causing us to say, well, maybe after 40 years, we need to take a second look at exactly how we fund schools. Is that sort of implied in the report?
I think that's implied. But I think, any program like this and any program that really has a significant impact on schools, on municipalities, on counties, on individuals, that's been in place for 20 years, a major program like this, should be evaluated at some point. Look at what the strengths and weaknesses are, and I think it's really time for that to happen here.
So, Dale, how would you envision something like that occurring? I know many years ago when I was a young person working at the state level, then Governor Tommy Thompson would have created a blue ribbon commission. Is that the sort of thing that needs to happen? Or maybe it's a legislative proposal that the legislature comes up with, perhaps debates and a presentation to the governor? Or is this something that a governor would have to put together but then present to the legislature? How do you see something like this occurring? And to further complicate things, it's not as though there's some magic answer to school financing somewhere in the country. There's all kinds of pressure points, and I don't know of anyone in this nation who is doing it right. So, Dale, what's the answer?
Well, I think I'm not one to recommend commissions, but I think in this case, a blue ribbon commission with experts in a variety of school issues, in state funding issues, in local funding issues, getting together and really identifying what's working, what was the objective, what's working, what's not working, how do we tweak it to make it work better? And it's not, remember, it's not just the law itself. This also goes to really, how are we going to fund these declining enrollment districts that are continued to decline, whether we have revenue limits or not? Because as that population shrinks on a per student basis, because your heating costs, your building costs, those costs are staying the same or growing, your per student costs are going to rise significantly. How do we fund those school districts? And we have a growing number of them.
Well, Dale, I would suggest if we're going to have some kind of a blue ribbon commission or a group of smart people get together and talk about the future of school funding, that we include demographers, some futurists, people that have an idea of where we want to be as a state in 20 or 30 years, because the decisions we make today on how we fund our schools are not only decisions which will affect today, they will affect the preparedness of this state for a successful future in 10, 20, 30, 40 years. So we have to be thinking way out front. And honestly, that's what the reports of Forward Analytics has done in virtually every case.
Yeah, I totally agree. And that's one of the reasons we're bringing this up now. Probably should have brought it up 5-10 years ago, but better late than never. And I think now when you look at these numbers, you have to say, now is the time to figure this out.
It is no wonder, Dale. Forward Analytics is the most respected research entity in the state. We've been talking with Dale Knapp, economist and director of Forward Analytics, and we can see all of Dale's work and the work of Forward Analytics at where, Dale?
forward-analytics.net.
And there's a direct link to the report and to that website in our show notes. And as always, find Local Gov Matters on your favorite podcast streaming service, from Apple Music to Spotify to Podbean to Stitcher. You can also link to the podcast from the WCA website at wicounties.org. And as always, please reach out to us with any topics or ideas or guests that you would like to see. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, we'll catch you next time on
Local Gov Matters.
Thanks, Dale, for being here.